You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Paul.
Hello, Robert. How are you?
I can't complain. How the heck are you, Paul Bloom?
I can't complain either, but I can't complain because I'm at my physical and mental peak.
Congratulations on that.
Quite
a few decades, didn't it, Paul?
You just reflexively say can't complain. I've heard your other podcasts, and can't complain is your reflexive answer.
Well, yeah, I can't, because you're not supposed to complain on podcasts at the beginning. I save it for the end, so I can't. I just can't. But you know what? I should introduce this. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter, to which everyone should subscribe. This is a Non-Zero podcast. You're Paul Bloom, publisher of the Small Potatoes Newsletter, to which everyone should subscribe. And this is still the Non-Zero podcast. And your famous globe-trotting, bon vivant psychologist, is it vivant?
Vivant. Vivant.
Anyway, you're you.
Renaissance man.
Renaissance man. That about does it.
Yeah, I think. That's it for me.
And a kind soul. So, I don't know. The world kind of feels like it's falling apart.
Various awful events just preceded, yesterday, day before.
A lot of killing. I mean, there was the attack on the Hanukkah celebration in Australia. There was the Brown University shooting. And then there was the Rob Reiner thing. And, you know, they're all technically in different categories. But I don't know. There's something that seemed like they had a unifying theme and it wasn't good. I couldn't quite articulate it.
Yeah, just bad luck. The Boston shooter is still on loose. Last I checked,
Providence.
Providence, Rhode Island.
I know all those non-Yale Ivy League schools are the same to you, Paul.
We just call them the lesser Ivies.
You are what now, an emeritus at Yale?
I am.
As befits a person of your age.
You're thinking so young. How's that possible?
Actually, I wasn't thinking that.
So young.
No, I wasn't thinking. But anyway, it was Brown, Providence, the killers at large. And you know, I would like to talk a little about how Elon Musk responded to this. And I think you had some thoughts about the way Donald Trump responded to the Rob Reiner killing.
You go first. I'll try.
I think Trump's response has gotten more attention. I think it has, you know, untold depths of analytical potential. I think it's even weirder than it seems.
Yeah.
So should I?
You go first with Elon, because I think people are less familiar with that. And I know, okay. I was.
So, there was this shooter at Brown, killed two people, wounded a number of students. And Musk, and this is typical of the way he gives, he kind of lends momentum to conspiracy theories. And by the way, do you know how many Twitter followers he has before we get to this?
The most of anybody, I would guess.
Do you know how many he has?
No, how many?
The number? Guess. Come on.
Twitter, I don't know. 200 million.
The answer is, that's pretty close. 230 million.
That's not bad.
Which is just a shocking amount of influence. So anyway, what you get is, you know, he does a lot of work with his replies. He just says things like 100% or exactly.
Horrible.
Horrible. Yeah. If it's about like white genocide or something that he wants to reinforce. Horrible. So in this case, what the tweet, I guess, said that he was replying to was, well, first of all, it was a quote tweet. So somebody had quoted that one of the students killed had been the vice president of the Republican Club. And so there's a tweet that just says that, which is true, I think. Mm-hmm. She was. And then somebody quote tweets it and says, they're going to keep calling the right Nazis so they can keep killing them. In other words, this person is saying it was a targeted killing. She was killed because she's a conservative, and it was in response to that Elon Musk says exactly 36,000 likes, 1,000 retweets, you know, a mere reply, but And it's a subtle, you know, it's a kind of oblique, it's a somewhat oblique suggestion that it was a target killing. And he could say, well, when I said exactly, I meant to be endorsing this part of the blah, blah, blah. But still, he just does this all the time. And he does lend momentum to very dubious stuff. Now, in this case, it's not impossible that she was killed because she's a conservative. But I would say there were dozens of people in this room. It was a study session. The person who led the study session said what happened was this guy comes in. He says some stuff the guy can't even understand. Nobody can understand what he's saying, but he's clearly terrifying. I guess they could see his gun. Students start streaming for the exits. And what the guy said is it was the students in the middle who were furthest from the exits who got shot.
Yeah.
Okay? That's the guy leading the session said this. It just does not sound like the gunman walked in and identified this woman. He had gone there to shoot. I mean, leave aside the fact that, when you're going to do a targeted killing on ideological grounds, you just usually do it as a targeted killing. I mean, I hate to be so tedious about this, but, you know, in debunking it, and look, there's still a 2% chance it could be true. But the point is, it is so irresponsible in the current climate, right, for him to fan the flames like this. Because the way countries dissolve into chaos and fighting and civil war is that one side gets, an exaggerated sense of the extent to which it is attacked and persecuted, then it does things that lead the other side to have the same exaggerated sense. And it's like a mutual amplification through positive feedback. And Musk so often plays this role. He is such a horrible human being. Although I don't honestly know for sure what's going on in his brain. I mean, he's like Trump in the sense that I don't have a theory I'm completely confident of.
I have somewhat of a theory because I see exactly what you're talking about. I sometimes end up on Twitter, less and less these days. And what I get, because I follow Elon Musk, I'm one out of 230 million, is I get these tweets or posts about rape, about some 14-year-old girl is raped by an Afghan immigrant.
Right.
And there's Elon Musk saying, horrible. How long are we going to stand for this? We must act, you know, basically doing, and this isn't a playbook of you know, pre-World War II Germany and every place where there's civil unrest.
Oh, they're raping our women.
They're raping our women.
The most powerful trope of xenophobia.
And in fact, there will always be crimes committed by people. And the what somebody will do to rile up a group is to pick out the crimes done by the people you hate, broadcast them, accelerate them. Look, the Jews did this. Maybe a Jew did do this, but you know, but you take it, you focus it, you say, horrible, we must act, we are under attack. And so what you're describing is part and parcel what Musk wants to do, which really is simply to foment hate. To foment hate against the people he views as his enemies.
I guess. I mean, I honestly don't know. Like, it doesn't seem impossible to me that he is just epistemologically challenged, that he's very smart in an engineering context, but his understanding of human society is so dim, and there's a fair amount of evidence that, look, he can't read the room and so on, you know, and that he has theory of mind deficit, that he's just not good at assessing probabilities of the kind I was just trying to tackle, you know, like, I don't know to what extent it's conscious, dishonest trolling and to what extent, because for example, he really was super pissed off apparently about one of his offspring who, what, became trans and disavowed Musk and whatever. So when he talks about the woke mind virus, I'm not sure he's not, you know, kind of serious. And look, you can describe any ideology as a mind virus in some kind of technical sense if you want to, but he takes it a little further than that.
I mean, there's a lot going on with Musk. I've always been, in some sense, a defender of him and saying he's extremely intelligent, off the charts, a genius in many ways, and a freaking moron in other ways. But what we're talking about, I think, can't be kind of brushed away as, oh, he's neurodivergent. This is not getting it. Because it's not like he has a low.
He is neurodivergent.
He is neurodivergent, but you know, I don't, but he doesn't get a pass for this because the conspiracies he promotes and the stories he pushes are always on one direction. It's never, you know, somebody says, wow, some right-wing people are doing some terrible stuff. And Elon Musk says, horrible, makes you think. It's never that.
But that's the way cognitive biases are. Yeah. I mean, we all genuinely believe our adversaries and enemies are worse than us. We can't all be right because they think the same thing about me. Somebody's got wrong.
The most flattering version of Musk, the most sort of cynical version is that he's cold-bloodedly and sort of with some sort of plan trying to structure hate against minority groups and hate against liberals. I think that the true version is he honestly believes it. He thinks that.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. I thought you were disagreeing, but I think to a considerable extent, I think he kind of does. And I mean, look, and there can be unflattering things about people that are true in some of his unflattering beliefs, maybe. But I mean, if you look at the sum total of his work on Twitter.
Yeah. His oeuvre.
Yeah. He's just buying into a lot of 100% bullshit and spreading it. And a lot of it is incendiary.
Yeah.
He's a strange case. By the way, Susan Wiles, I sadly did not have time to read this. Did you hear about the Vanity Fair article where about Susie Wiles, Trump's chief of staff?
No.
She I'll cut to the chase. She is quoted as calling Musk, quote, an odd duck.
Well, that's true. Even his fans must go with that.
So, there's a lot of kind of partial quotes, and she says J.D. Vance has long believed in conspiracy theories or something. And then she complains that they're taken out of context. And she also says, much of what I and others said about the team and the president was left out of the story. Paul, can you believe that? I thought Vanity Fair was just a transcript service. Like, I mean, I am shocked.
You journalists just stand together. Criticize one, everyone else could.
I was just thinking, like, why did she submit to these interviews, you know, unless it was she was like the sister-in-law of the person who's going to write the story? And the answer seems to be she doesn't understand the first thing about journalism, which is that you leave some shit out, okay?
I refuse to talk about Vanity Fair unless we're going to talk about Olivia Nuzzi.
I'm game. I'm game.
Have you been following Ryan Liz's Substack posts?
Yeah. I mean, this is kind of a couple weeks old, right?
I know. I mean, one came out yesterday.
Oh, you keep reading. What's the latest? So this is her former fiance, and I'm starting to sense that their relationship is not what it once was.
You picked that up. Yes. Yes.
She's this journalist who I guess we think had sex with RFK Jr. And Liz says had sex with Mark Sanford, famous hiker of the Appalachian Trail. We talked about Appalachian Trail. What's the latest? So bring us the news.
The latest is Ryan Liz is continuing claiming that Olivia has done a longstanding campaign to try to portray him as an insane stalker and perhaps a violent person threatening her life.
And how come I haven't heard her doing that? Have you heard her doing that? Yeah. Oh, maybe she's just telling her friends in private that he's a stalker.
No, this ended up in some. She managed to plant the story. I mean, according to him, plant the story in some news outlets that were unusually credulous. There is, I mean, he tells this story and it's entertaining. I got to zoom in on this because it's a question of the sort of psychology of responsibility, which is, he says he went to New York with a plan to spend 24 hours there, meet her, tell her, stop this. We got to try not to destroy each other. We got to be quiet about this. Let this go away. And everything like that. I'm here to support you. And then he says something, I don't have it in front of me. He says something like that. She's so scheming and bizarre and self-centered. We ended up spending 5 days in a hotel together. And I'm thinking,
I hate it when women scheme like that.
You know, you got to take some agency here.
Yeah.
Some responsibility. Okay. Yeah. So if we talk about bad responses to murders, Trump surprised me. Like, even for Trump, his response to Rob Reiner's death was bizarre. and strangely cruel. So not only did he insult the guy and say what an awful person he was for challenging Trump and critical Trump, he seemed to believe at the time that Rob Reiner was killed because of his anti-Trump beliefs. And while for any normal person, this would lead to guilt, it would lead to saying, I'm not in favor of violence in any way. Trump seemed to say he's dead and it was his fault. He made people angry because of his hatred of me, Donald J. Trump. And so he got what he deserved. This is not verbatim, but this is the thrust of it. And I mean, that's how I read it.
Yeah.
And
no,
that's astonishing.
It is really weird. And that's why, like, you know, when people say, doesn't Trump know you're not supposed to speak ill of the recently deceased? That's not the weirdest thing.
Yeah, that's not the weirdest thing.
You know, here's what he says. Trump says so-and-so has passed away together with his wife, Michelle, reportedly due to the anger he caused others through his massive, unyielding, and incurable affliction with a mind-crippling disease known as, and this part's in caps, Trump Derangement Syndrome, sometimes referred to as TDS. He was known to have driven people crazy, in caps, by his raging obsession with President Donald J. Trump, with his obvious paranoia reaching new heights as the Trump administration surpassed all goals and expectations of greatness, and with the golden age of America upon us, perhaps like never before. And then I love the last one. May Rob and Michelle rest in peace.
That's beautiful.
That's beautiful. Oh, that's beautiful, Donald.
I hear that, and it seems to me he says that mistakenly that Reiner and his wife were murdered because he was angry at Trump. He was murdered by people who were offended that he's angry at Trump, and he got what he deserves. And
yeah, he did say it was reportedly due to the anger.
Yes.
Yeah, no, I have a theory about this.
Oh, yeah?
About what was going on in his brain. And I do think, you know, look, he's going to be 80 in June. It may be that, you know, how old was Biden when he ceased to finish sentences? I mean,
I know 80-year-olds.
I know 100-year-olds. You know who's 100 is Dick Van Dyke, whose show, by the way, he turned 100 this week, whose show, the Dick Van Dyke Show, was created by Rob Reiner's father, Carl Reiner.
Oh, that's a good connection.
But I digress.
That's good.
Yeah, no, Dick Van Dyke, I think he's still, you know, there's huge variation in this, obviously. But I'm just saying things could get weirder in Trump's brain. And I think in a way this is a sign of that. Now, my theory is
this is the second time, by the way, in the first half of our podcast, you are excusing people's terrible behavior in terms of cognitive impairments.
Did I excuse myself? See, this, I don't do blame. I don't do blame.
You don't do blame. I'm going to remind you next time you do blame.
I don't believe in, I believe we have to apportion blame and punishment and credit and reward just to keep society humming. But I don't believe in the justice of retribution, for example.
Okay, fair enough.
So, but anyway, here's my theory about what is kind of going on in Trump's brain. I have long been of the view that, contrary to a popular thing to say, which is, oh, he's smart. He's a lot smarter than people realize. He's not very smart. He has good bully instincts, and he's smarter than the average playground bully. And he has good political demagogue instincts, and he's as smart as the average political demagogue. But basically, much of his, and then he has specific skills. He's kind of funny in a way that's right for his audience. And so on. And but basically, I think he's usually going on bully and or demagogue instinct. And one bully instinct is you try to get out the message that anyone who messes with you is punished. They suffer. So like, for example, if you're a playground bully and somebody and some guy who is your enemy, like, gets beat up in some part of town and somebody says, were you in the vicinity of that? You know, the bully would say, huh, you never know. Or, whenever there's ambiguity, your instinct would be to, you know, lend credence to the idea that the person suffered because they messed, right? Good bully instinct. So maybe that's just what's going on here. I don't know. And it's like, again, it's like Musk. Does he? I mean, Trump is so narcissistic, and in that way, he's like Musk, that I can well imagine that if somewhere in the corners of Truth Social, somebody said, this, you know, this is probably somebody standing up for Donald Trump who punished Rob Reiner as he should. I can well imagine Trump going, yeah, that's probably what happened. You know?
There's just, I'm old enough to remember back in the day, you're not supposed to celebrate the idea that one of your followers murdered somebody because they were critical
of
you.
Well, that's a weird thing. Normally you deny that. Normally, right? That's the way the dynamic works. You know, the liberals don't want to accept, or whoever's being blamed for Charlie Kirk's murder, the left, the woke, whatever, would rather not.
Right.
Have to admit that.
Imagine Gavin Newsom being president, and then Charlie Kirk gets murdered, and Newsom posts a tweet saying, you know, well, this guy was an asshole. He was critical of me, so I guess he got what he deserved. That nobody else would do that.
No, it is, and I'm glad you focused on that, because a lot of people are just saying, you know, this is appalling. You shouldn't say this kind of thing. That's not the weirdest part. The weirdest part is what you zeroed in on. And it's really weird. And I do think it's weirder than first-term Trump.
Yeah. And I always wonder at what point do people who are his diehard followers say, that's kind of disgusting. That's a bit too much.
Well, we'll tune into the All In podcast this Friday to see when that finally happens. I mean, that's perfect, because Musk is the other guy who gets zero criticism. I mean, he's even more criticism-proof on All In, because Jason Calacanis, who's supposedly the token, I guess, non-something. I mean, he's barely, I don't know that he's left of center, but he's the closest thing to a token liberal or a token progressive. He will occasionally, you know, he will sometimes raise questions about Trump, but he has long been a total Musk suck-up and friend. So Elon Musk, and, you know, David Sachs is a protege of Musk's. So Elon is untouchable, and you just got to ask, like, at some point, you know, don't you just owe it to something to just start suggesting, like, the truth about a completely horrible, massively destructive human being? I'll ask you that.
What's the current state of the relationship between Musk and Trump?
Oh, it's good again. Musk's choice for NASA head apparently now is going to be NASA head. When they had their breakup, that was suddenly not going to be the case.
Okay.
But now it looks like Musk is going to have his man at NASA, last I heard. And that seems to me pretty clearly a sign that they've kissed and made up.
Yeah. So Musk is kind of walking back the whole the president's a pedophile thing.
Oh, he hasn't talked trash about Trump in a pretty long time, I think, yeah.
More Epstein pictures have come out, and I'm relieved to see you aren't in any of them.
Yeah, well, you know.
Always been camera shy.
There's a lot about me you don't know, Paul. Yeah, the Epstein, did you have time to read the...
I did not read the Epstein financial story.
New York Times just did a big piece about how he actually wound up rich. I asked an AI to give me the big takeaway, and one of them was that he apparently convinced both Wexman and Leon Black, his two biggest benefactors, I think, that their finances were a mess, and they couldn't trust the people who were taking care of their finances, and they needed to bring him in to straighten things out. Something like that.
Huh. Okay.
I don't know.
So that's the sort of non-conspiratorial theory of his wealth, because it doesn't involve foreign governments and intelligence entanglements.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, he's smart enough. Both of them were pretty ardently pro-Israel. And I'm sure, you know, Epstein was smart enough, whatever his actual views on the subject were, if he didn't share those beliefs, to feign them. Because, you know, that really... It is a trust builder. Like, if you feel super strongly about any cause and then there's somebody else who shares that belief, you're just more likely to trust them with everything, your money, whatever. So I think, you know, the ideology probably figured in, at least in that way. But
so if our thing, I mean, Once we finish these episodes, somebody, maybe Clark, maybe you, has a title for them. And mm-hmm. the title for this one is like Bad Men or Trolls. Because I want to sort of segue into Nick Fuentes, who I had never heard talk.
Okay, but first, Paul, what if they see the headline Bad Men, they see the picture of us and they think we're the bad men?
Or trolls. That's true. That never occurred to me.
Any of this would make sense. So I don't think we should encourage these interpretations. But anyway, yeah, Nick Fuentes, you directed me to the Piers Morgan Nick Fuentes interview, and I listened to as much as I could stand.
I listened to 2 hours of it.
Oh my God.
I didn't sit sort of still. I did it while walking, doing chores, maybe fast forwarded past a bit of it, but I feel like I understand Nick Fuentes now. And here's a mystery to me, which I asked my son about, and my son partially helped resolve it. But here's the mystery. Think of Andrew Tate. So Andrew Tate is this MMA guy, very, very popular, big following. And I get the appeal of Andrew Tate. He's a muscled up, good looking guy. He's mostly filmed with his shirt off, showing off all of his muscles. He's an MMA fighter, very, very masculine pursuit. And he boasts about sleeping with innumerable women. So now he's a misogynist. And guy with an extremely ugly ideology. But I could see how a certain sort of young guy would say, I want to be like Andrew Tate. Now compare with Nick Fuentes, who is, you know, based on his physical appearance, has not spent a huge amount of time in the gym, is by his own confession in his late 20s, is a virgin. He's not gay. He just,
I don't think he considers it a confession, but yeah, he calls himself an incel. He calls himself an incel.
So I'm wondering, I hadn't heard him say, like, but yeah. I could see why young guys would follow Andrew Tate. I wish they wouldn't. It's a very ugly set of views, but where's the, oh my God, I want to be like Nick Fuentes. I want to follow Nick Fuentes. So I asked my son, and he said, who was in his late 20s. He said that Andrew Tate appeals to sort of older kind of guy who wants to have sex and be tough and everything. There's a certain community of young guys who are just sort of, you know, I don't know what term he used, not exactly soy boys, but they don't want to chase women. They might see themselves as incels and not in a bad way. They're not sexually motivated. They're not motivated to bulk up. They're just kind of, not his word, but I call them kind of losers, and they see Nick Fuentes one of them.
Well, I think, I think, first of all, Fuentes is valuable as some kind of barometer. He's got a following, and it's what the appeal is an interesting question. And I certainly don't think, I think his coalition is, for one thing, people who are sick of hearing that they're not allowed to say disparaging things about groups of people they don't like.
That was a big part of his shtick with Piers Morgan.
So, and for some of them, it's women. And for some of them, it's because they haven't had success with women.
Yeah.
And that's part of the coalition.
And so Piers Morgan, who I think is, I hadn't actually heard much of him either. So he's a good interviewer. He's a little bit, encouraging in some way, inadvertently promoting this guy. But there's one who'd be like outraged. How dare you make a Holocaust joke? How dare you? Don't you understand? And then Fuentes would say, it's funny. Lighten up. You're an old guy. Nobody cares. Oh, you're pearl clutching and everything. And that's the way it went. You know, Piers Morgan would say, you're calling yourself a racist. How can you? And Fuentes said, I'm a racist. Ha ha. Get old. I'm going to cry. And that was for 2 hours. That's what happened.
Now, on that part, I kind of missed what came before. Did he initially say, yes, I'm a racist. Everyone's a racist?
Yes. So in some way, it's horseshoe theory, which is the people who believe everybody's a racist are people on the extreme left and the extreme right. Mm-hmm. You know, I know people who think everyone's a racist. We have our old bias. We're all racist. And there's no real difference between a member of the KKK and you and me. We all have these unconscious biases. And then on the extreme right, you have Fuentes saying, basically, you know, what he said, and it's not, you know, in some way, I think there's a germ of truth here. The Jews care about the Jews. The Jews think, you know, like the Jews. The Muslims like the Muslims. So I'm a white guy. I'm a white European guy. I like my own kind. And a Christian. And I like Christians. And it's you, Piers Morgan, who are some sort of beta cosmopolitan who falls outside all of that.
Yeah, I found Piers Morgan very frustrating because I think they just had kind of a common interest.
That's right.
In not getting clear on anything, you know, like and just persisting with the outrage. And so
that's right. That's right. Fuente's interest was to look how offensive I can be. You know, I'm gonna laugh at you. And Morgan's interest was saying, you're disgusting. This is contemptible.
Yeah. I mean, Fuentes, so a lot of what he generates outrage for is making blanket statements about groups, yeah. Right? Women are this, Jews are that, blacks are this. And now they did drill down a little on one of them, and he just kind of backed off what that one seems to mean. And I'm referring to this quote, I don't have it before me. He says something about, about Jews and women and blacks. And the thing he says about blacks is basically, and blacks should be jailed for the most part. And what he says he meant by that is that the ones who have committed crimes should be in jail. Well, that's a very different thing to say, right? And the thing Piers Morgan didn't do and kept not doing is in this case, say, wait a second, do you not understand that when people hear you say blacks should be jailed for the most part, they think you just mean that most blacks should be in jail? I mean, you know, because in a way, the thing you absolutely positively could have nailed Fuentes on is, it's like Musk. It's the completely irresponsible use of language, except that I think Musk means, you know, Musk may mean what he said, whereas Fuentes, when you press him, at least in this case, he actually backed way off of it. And I just would have liked to see Morgan say, no, wait, well, and you know what another example is? When he kept saying, yeah, Hitler's cool. Hitler's cool. I am, you know, my instinct is to say, wait, let's just clear. What do you mean by cool?
Yeah.
A lot of people, when they say cool, they mean worth moral emulation, right? They lump that together with cool. Cool people are people you emulate. Well, what do you mean? And Piers Morgan never did that kind of drilling down. And that would have been useful because I do think to a large extent the game Fuentes is playing, and I assume it's a conscious game, but is to speak in blanket generalizations, but to be ready to say something more precise and subtle if you actually challenge him.
Maybe. Or maybe you're giving him too much credit. I don't know.
Maybe.
He would say things like, he said, you know, we should, if you're white, you shouldn't have any black friends. You know, you should stay away from blacks. They're dangerous. And then Piers Morgan says, you have black friends. I have plenty of black friends. Okay. He would talk about the Holocaust is blown out of proportion, whatever. And then Piers Morgan, so you don't, how many people do you think died in the Holocaust? Oh, 6 or 7 million.
He said seven.
This is seven. He gave us an extra million.
He's a maximalist.
that's right. Although at one point, and I think I might have missed it, but I saw a quote, he said, or maybe 100 times more, which I take it as like a little, you know, giving the finger saying, you know, but he came off the whole time as, you know, a naughty 14-year-old, you know, talking shit to upset people.
And but I mean, he is verbally pretty agile.
Yeah. He doesn't have ums and ahs and hesitations.
And he doesn't waste time on nuance. That's for sure. Doesn't waste time trying to find exactly the right statistical characterization of the group correlated behavior he's talking about. But he comes off as sincere. Did you listen to the Tucker Carlson interview a few weeks ago? Well, that's different because it's Carlson's not as unsympathetic, although he eventually gets around to challenging things he says about Jews. But that's interesting because you see how when he's wholly unchallenged, which he usually is, right? He's speaking to his audience. There's no antagonistic interrogator. You see how he could just come off as kind of the real deal. He sounds sincere. He tells the story of how he started out by just asking innocent questions about Israel. Why do we give Israel so much money? He gets blowback from Ben Shapiro, blah, blah, blah. He's an effective rhetorician. And I'm alarmed that the, you know, again, unnuanced things he says have as big an audience as they seem to have. On the other hand, you know, people like Piers Morgan are helping build it up.
I think that that's exactly what Piers Morgan is doing. I don't know. I mean, in some way, I was underwhelmed. Like, I don't mean like he did not persuade me of his views. I don't mean that. I mean that I listened to somebody like Tucker Carlson, and I've always been impressed with Tucker Carlson as a guy with a lot of sharpness and a lot of intelligence, directed often in malevolent ways, but a guy of real powerful rhetorical gifts. And I will say this again, I will not be surprised to see him rise high in the Republican Party, and I could see him as a presidential nominee one day. But Fuentes just seemed like a troll, an articulate troll, but a troll.
I guess. I mean, it's kind of like Musk. I'm not 100% sure what's going on in his head. Look, I think he basically has a version of the beliefs he professes.
Yeah.
I think he by and large blames women for the fact that he's never had sex with one. And although I don't know, I couldn't tell. I mean,
that I couldn't tell. And he actually never, I mean, maybe it's not as relevant, but he never, you know, Morgan never pursued it. I would have thought he might think that it's just you can't have sex before marriage and he's not married yet.
Well, I wonder. He says he's a devout Catholic or something.
Sort of. Yeah. There was a moment where Morgan said that if the Pope repudiated his beliefs, what would Fuentes feel about this? And Fuentes said, I'd be very hurt. And I kind of like that. That was a rare moment of honesty. And it suggests that the guy really is Catholic. And, you know, if you're Catholic, you don't want, you know, I think this happened to J.D. Vance already, but you don't want the Pope to crap all over you.
Yeah, well, better than Steve Bannon, who would say, I don't think he should be Pope anyway. But Bannon has an alternative Pope.
Really?
He does.
Like one in the wings? He would like.
Oh, there's a right way. Yeah, there's this right-wing guy who they put people like Bannon push. So yeah, that was, it's good to see this kind of respect for a basically left of center Pope, I guess, coming from Nick Fuentes. But it's he's a little bit of a puzzle. It's not a good sign that he has much of a following at all.
No, it really is not.
I don't know. So are we almost to overtime time? What time are we at?
We have so much more to talk about. We have Oliver Sacks and a new
Oliver Sacks quasi scandal.
The revelations that the man really did not mistake his wife for a hat. Maybe not totally.
And I actually have an anecdote that's very relevant to this. I edited him.
Oh,
and had lunch with him once. And there was an episode in the course of our editing is strikingly germane to the allegation here, which I guess is pretty well documented, which is that he put words in the mouths of the patients whose behavior he was documenting in these pieces. Now, did he write pieces for The New Yorker? Because this piece was in The New Yorker. But it wasn't like cast as an expose. They kind of buried the lead.
It's by Rachel Aviv, who's a very good writer, who writes about, among other things, about mental illness. And she's a very, very good writer. And it was largely Oliver Sacks' experience as a gay man in a world very unforgiving of gay men and his problems in finding love and so on. And you're like halfway into the article. Basically, what this article is built on, the discovery of journals that had not yet been, by Sachs's own journals, which had not yet been revealed to the public.
Mm-hmm.
I got to say, we'll talk about this more, but I don't think the neuroscience community is going to be stunned at this. I remember talking when I was a graduate student at MIT saying, oh my God, Oliver Sacks, have you heard this thing about it? And somebody who knew a lot about it feels that that is total bullshit. He is just making shit up. People don't really do that. And apparently this was true. Everything was made up. All of these wonderful stories that capture these perfect, so let me just jump in. We're going to talk about this. Steve, so I, the New Yorker thing came up. I put it on Twitter, on
subs. You're on to overtime before too long, just so that you don't give away too much for free, which I know you hate to do, Paul, but go ahead.
I put it on Substack notes. Nobody looked at it. Pinker, Steve Pinker, my friend, had a little thing on it in Twitter. And then, of course, that caused it to go viral. That's what you ended up reading. And because maybe you don't read the New Yorker when it appears on your mailbox. But Steve said something which struck me as true, which is, where's the New Yorker's famous fact checkers?
Yeah. So in other words, Sacks had written some of this stuff for the New Yorker, right?
Yes. Although I'm now wondering whether
he also wrote for the New York Review of Books,
whether it was excerpts of his books, which maybe run a different fact checking standard.
No, although it. Certain times, who was his editor? You know, I just watched part of this documentary about Robert Gottlieb, who was an editor. Knopf maybe was not Sachs's editor, though, but he was also editor of The New Yorker. Probably during part of this time. Anyway
we should talk about this.
What's that?
We should talk about this more in overtime.
Oh, definitely. It's an interesting phenomenon.
It is very interesting. And
he was a very interesting guy. I mean, I don't know when he died, but for people real young may have no idea who he is. But for people of our generation, and even a little younger, well, from mine and even yours and even younger, that's kind of 2.5 generations. He was this superstar, and he was this, this humane, physician. He was, and I think, he was kind of the left-wing medical scientist.
That's
in
right.
A certain sense.
That's
that,
right.
I mean,
he had a movie made of his, I think Awakenings was his
Awakenings
first, book, played by Robin Williams.
Right. That was the one where he gives them the drug L-DOPA. I don't think they were Parkinson's patients, although L-DOPA has mainly used for Parkinson's. But anyway, they had been in some sense kind of frozen. And then L-DOPA comes along and he gives it to them. And the movie is about the magical things that happen. And it turns out that one of the things that in his book that it's based on, he attributes to one of the patients is something that the patient almost certainly didn't say, because Sacks had been, in his own writing, he is seen saying it separately and before that. It's his, it's some line of his, it's some reference to the real, is it Rilke or Rilke, the poet, whatever.
Yeah.
Anyway, he was a huge, I guess he was in both the New York Review of Books and the New Yorker.
Where did you edit him for?
It was at the Sciences, and my Paul Labosky, who was the editor, said to me, but when he was just starting to take off, I'm sure this was before the Awakenings book. I assume it was. It was in the early 80s. He said, this guy's going to be big. We should get him on our pages. So I contacted him somehow, and we did. But, Paul, we should go into overtime. Okay. I'll tell you the rest of the story. It is germane. It's a real cliffhanger.
Other topics?
Speaking of which,
the pluribus?
Pluribus? I have some shit to talk about Pluribus.
Oh, I hope don't. I love the show. Don't ruin it.
Well, we just may have to disagree, Paul. No, I like it in a lot of ways, but
is it too slow for you, Bob?
We don't want to. No plot spoilers,
okay,
Paul.
Okay.
Plot spoilers.
The second thing is, and this
but
is
yes,
this,
yeah. And episode 7 removed all doubt. Okay,
it was leisurely.
Leisurely is
like
such
it.
A fine description of that kind of shit.
Also, and this is for those academics among us who stay through the whole thing. Apparently, it turns out that students in university of like Brown and Harvard, over 20% of them are designated as disabled. And is disabled in the sense of cognitively disabled in terms of ADHD and associated disorders. And And it's an example of incentives at work. And we can talk about that. I think
this is something we may not disagree on, actually.
Oh, okay. Well, pluribus, we have plenty to disagree on. I adore the show.
Okay.
Okay.
So, thanks, everyone. The way you can get access to the overtime segment is to be a paid subscriber to either Paul Bloom's Small Potatoes or the Non-Zero Newsletter. And you can go to those sites and find the missing, what you'll be missing if you're not. And also, Paul, should we say a little about how heartened they should feel by the knowledge that they're supporting endeavors such as ours? Or should we just be strictly transactional about it and say, look, you want to hear Bob's Oliver Sacks anecdote? Let's see a little green. Which,
well, we can't help but say, as some a wiser person said, democracy dies in darkness. So people, you know, supporting us is really the last bastion of rationality and the life of the mind, honesty.
Honesty dies in darkness, folks.
Your sharp journalistic instincts and my plucky Canadian enthusiasm. So, smash the like button, enroll, send us money.
PCE, I think that deserves an acronym.
If people are watching this on video, you will see there's pieces of wood behind me because we're renovating. This has not come cheap. So, just saying.
Let me just say in passing, it has been shown in the past that Paul's background is 100% fake. Now, maybe he's changed. Maybe he's turned over a new leaf. And maybe the problem is that because we're not recording on Zoom this time, he can no longer, be quite that dishonest. But in the past, it's all been a lie.
The wood is real.
Okay. We'll take your word for it.
Taking that out of context, that's a strange sentence. Okay. Here we go.
Okay. All right. Thanks, folks.
Bye.
We're heading into overtime.